produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. This is Free Culture Radio. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs nor condemns people for being involved in drugs. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when people who use drugs are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. The New School in New York City recently held a fascinating web conference. It was entitled Decolonizing Drug Policy: Perspectives from the Americas and Asia. As they noted in the program, quote, like healthcare, housing, and criminal justice, drug policy too bears the marks of racism and colonialism. The brunt of punitive and prohibitive drug policies has long been borne by indigenous people and people of color across the world. How are these policies being challenged globally? Can decriminalization and legalization undo the harms of racist and imperialist drug wars? What does a truly decolonized drug policy look like? On today's show, we'll hear from a couple of the panelists. First, Isabel Pereira is the research coordinator of De Justicia, the drug policy area of the Center for the Study of Law, Justice, and Society, where she focuses on the impacts of drug policy on human rights. She's a member of the Research Consortium for Drugs and the Law and is regional representative for Latin America and the Caribbean for the International Drug Policy Consortium.
The Andean countries in Latin America, Bolivia, Colombia, Peru, all have used the coca leaves for centuries. But since the implementation of the international treaties by which coca has been stigmatized and vilified, it has been mostly erased from recent history. Not only that, colonial powers and post-colonial powers equate coca with cocaine. This is also something that has been internalized within our country themselves. There was an example that I wanted to share with you. In 2008, a commercial was aired in national television that said, and it was from public TV, that said, do not grow the plants that kills. Translates into Spanish, la mata que mata, no cultive la mata que mata. And it basically equated coca with cocaine, and it just said blatantly that coca was a plant that killed, ignoring completely that this was a plant that has been used by indigenous communities for medicinal purpose, for ritualistic purposes, for working, for enhancing their minds. And it has also been incorporated into our national jurisdiction within the treaties with a reserve, recognizing that it has this heritage value and that it is a part of the indigenous heritage values. But because there are what I call, what many call the champions of prohibition within our country, even us have internalized this narrative that coca is the same as cocaine and that coca is a plant that kills. Only very recently so, there have been permits awarded by national institutions to allow for research on what coca is. And that is outrageous for us to be looking at a plant that has been present for millennia in these territories, but not know what their components are, what the uses are, where the potential benefits are. Of course, the indigenous communities know all this, but it has really limited scientific progress. It has limited our knowledge of what we have in our regions. And then another just quick example before I give the floor back to you, Kasia, is how our relationships with global powers have limited the funding of what can be allocated to drug policy. So basically, as Colombia is the main producer of cocaine across the world, so our agenda of what to do about drug policy is mainly defined by what the U.S. wants us to do about drug policy. So what would it look like for social justice and for U.S. drug policy towards Colombia? I think a first very urgent matter is recognition of the harms that have been caused because of U.S. policy towards Colombia. That does not equate that we're not responsible as well. Colombia society has been a very strong champion of prohibition as well. But it has been with the pressure of the U.S. just breathing on our necks to be decertified if we are not to reduce the coca cultivated in our country. And though the funding that has been directed to security forces, which had a direct impact on human rights of very marginalized and communities that were asking just for rural reform for years, but instead were reigned over with glyphosate. And I think this is a very current conversation with domestic conversations that are happening in Colombia. As you know, a peace agreement was signed in 2016 between the government and the oldest insurgent group. And one of the issues, one of the institutions that peace agreement created was a truth commission. From the Justicia and other organizations and just social movements, there is a need for this transitional justice mechanisms to speak to the harms of drug policy. Armed conflict was a whole other beast, but drug policy was the motor and the fuel that made for the harm so much bigger, so much greater, and the impact so much larger. And then connecting to your other question, Kasia, on how can this link to broader social justice issues? We are at this point trying to understand that and beginning to understand that unless drug policy reform speaks to other broader social movements such as land reform, such as environmental justice, such as indigenous rights, there will be no place for a strong drug policy reform if we don't have the structures and mechanisms put in place that can receive regulation. To make myself a bit clear, what has happened, for example, with the medical marijuana business in Colombia has been that those who grew marijuana for decades, those who were incarcerated for marijuana for decades, are not in any way a part of this booming industry, million-dollar industry. Because there were no systems in place, there were no capacities and capabilities enough for them to accede to the high level of standards that a pharmaceutical industry was claiming for. So if we try to envision, for example, cocaine regulation, and try to dream about it. It's not enough to dream about it if we don't work for the structures that will sustain it to be just and to be fair and to be based on human rights before that regulation comes along. The issue of how farmers are involved in those processes is of the most importance because they have been saying for years what is needed in their communities. But because policy has been led from these relations between US and Colombia at a very excluding manner, there has been no space for policy to be designed with the intents and with the needs of people in mind. And then just one quick note that it was a nice news on Twitter this morning. A social leader in Colombia called Francia Márquez sent a letter to Vice President Kamala Harris. Francia is a longstanding Afro leader from the southeast in Colombia, and she sent a letter to her, just congratulating her, but also asking her to engage in what is happening in Colombia with the killings of social leaders, with the urgency of implementing the peace agreement, and also including the issue of drug policy and how prohibition has harmed Afro and peasant communities. This is quite new. The distance between drug policy reform and social movements is slowly getting shorter and shorter, which is a gain in itself. It used to be just drug policy reform people being too liberal and the other social movements on their side. So I hope that a meeting between Francia Márquez and Kamala Harris signals this kind of collaboration between very big decolonizing efforts.
That was Isabel Pereira. She's the research coordinator of De Justicia, the drug policy area of the Center for the Study of Law, Justice, and Society. She was speaking on a webinar held recently by the New School entitled Decolonizing Drug Policy, Perspectives from the Americas and Asia. I'm Doug McVeigh. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. We'll be back in a moment. Washington State Representative Lauren Davis is the executive director of the Washington Recovery Alliance. She's also the chief sponsor of House Bill 1499, providing behavioral health system responses to individuals with substance use disorder. A hearing was held on that bill February 12th before the State House Public Safety Committee. Here's Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning to the chair and my fellow committee members. For the record, State Representative Lauren Davis from the 32nd District. I want to thank the chair very, very much for hearing this bill and to the many of you on this committee who've been so generous with your time and meeting with me on this topic to work on a proposed substitute that Rep. Clippert alluded to. And also want to thank my amazing co-sponsor, Rep. Harris Talley. There is nearly universal agreement that our state's response to addressing substance use disorder is woefully inadequate. Our collective inaction reminds me of that Bob Dylan lyric, "How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see?" The bill before you proposes a paradigm shift in the state's response to untreated addiction. It is an assertion that we must do more, not less. We are proposing this legislation not because the current situation is unproblematic, but because the current situation is incredibly problematic. Something has to change. We must be proactive rather than reactive. We must not wait until someone comes crashing into the criminal legal system. We must build bridges to get them help right now. A few years ago, a dear friend of mine from the recovery community relapsed. He called me begging for help. I drove to meet him that night, and I spent the next several weeks doing everything I could to keep him alive. Much of that time was spent in motel rooms, covered in blood, needles, baggies, heroin, meth, and lighters. When the breath would leave his body in the midst of an overdose, I would violently shake him awake. I watched him tie off his bicep with the auxiliary cord in my car. The blood spatter still remains on my passenger side visor. There was one particular night that I will never forget. He couldn't find a vein and was growing increasingly frustrated. He would trace his bruised and swollen arms up and down, looking for a spot. He bent over and tried his foot, first the right, then the left. When that didn't work, he went into the bathroom, looked in the mirror, and puffed out his neck in an effort to inject there. After several hours of this, his arms, face, and legs were covered in blood. He began to weep. Tears streamed down his cheeks, and he whimpered, "I can't stop. I can't stop." His suffering was deep and profound. His suffering was so many things, but it shouldn't have been illegal. He deserved help, not handcuffs. Substance use disorder is a response to trauma. The real question is not why the drugs, but why the pain. Opioids, for example, numb not only the brain centers that experience physical pain, but also those that experience emotional pain. This disease is about not wanting to experience the present because it is too painful a place to be. When we arrest and incarcerate individuals, we only multiply the pain to be numbed. One of the diagnostic criteria for substance use disorder is continued use despite negative consequences. Therefore, it is implausible that imposing additional negative consequences through the criminal legal system will lead to a cessation of use. Substance use disorder is rooted in brokenness and isolation. It is fueled by shame. Brené Brown explains it this way. Shame is the fear of disconnection. It's the fear that something we've done or something we failed to do makes us unworthy of connection. Shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we're flawed and therefore unworthy of love, belonging, and connection. It is true that there are some individuals who credit their recovery to the criminal legal system. In fact, a few of my friends fall into that category. But that is the exception, not the rule. And generally, legislating to the exception does not create good public policy. It's also important to note that for those who do enter treatment and recovery via the criminal legal system, it is rarely for a possession charge. More typically, it's due to pretrial diversion programs or sentencing alternatives related to crimes against persons or property. For most individuals, incarceration serves only to amplify feelings of shame, worthlessness, and hopelessness. It furthers a person's belief that they are less than, that they are other. It indelibly marks them with a conviction that will make it infinitely more difficult to ever attain housing and employment, both of which are highly correlated with long-term recovery. Recovery is predicated on hope. It is born of connection. People recover not when we cast them out, but when we bring them in. Research tells us that hope requires three components: a goal, a pathway, and agency, the belief in one's own ability to get and stay on the path. When we meet people in active addiction where they are, when we love them fiercely and unconditionally, when we treat them as people of worth and dignity, when we honor their humanity, we forge relationships. The opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it's connection. In all my years of work in this field, I can say that what keeps people from seeking treatment boils down to two reasons. One, they don't think recovery is possible for them. And two, they don't think they're worthy of recovery. The barrier to their engagement in services is not an absence of pain, it's an absence of hope. Sometimes if you can't see it, you can't be it. That's why it's imperative that the individuals employed and trained to do outreach and engagement with this population are people who have walked this road themselves and are now thriving in recovery. These are recovery coaches or substance use disorder peers, and they deal in the currency of hope and motivation. The substance use disorder continuum of care has three parts: outreach, treatment, and recovery support services. When we build genuine trust with individuals in active addiction, when we provide rapid access to quality treatment, when we offer recovery support services like housing and employment, recovery is not only possible, but probable. We know what works, but that's not the system we've built. We fund one leg of a three-legged stool. We pay for treatment over and over because insurance covers it, but we fail to fund the outreach on the front end and the recovery support services on the back end that are absolutely foundational to fostering sustained recovery. The Pathways to Recovery Act gets us there. It creates a robust continuum of care for substance use disorder that is accessible to all communities from urban to rural. It provides a behavioral health system response to a treatable brain disease. Please join me in supporting House Bill 1499. No one has fallen too far to recover. If only we'd give them a chance. Thank you.
That was Washington State Representative Lauren Davis. She was testifying before the state legislature's House Public Safety Committee on House Bill 1499, of which she's the chief sponsor. Welcome back. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you're listening to Free Culture Radio. Let's hear more now from that recent webinar held by the New School entitled Decolonizing Drug Policy, Perspectives from the Americas and Asia. The Reverend Dr. Charles Boyer is founding director of Salvation and Social Justice. Dr. Boyer is a leading faith voice in New Jersey for the campaign to abolish the drug war and to end the criminalization of black people.
You know, it's fascinating hearing firsthand how American drug policy colonizes the rest of the world. And I think as we have seen in a lot of really repressive, oppressive ways, America tends to lead the pack and show an example. And it has always done so in the way that it has treated black citizens, right? So for folks who have wanted to really be oppressive, a lot has been learned for how America treats African-Americans and black folks in general. And so the colonization discussion is fascinating because in the context of how we kind of outsource our oppressive ways, but also how colonization takes place in black communities and communities of color in poor communities throughout the United States more specifically so in urban centers in New Jersey. It's also kind of important to understand that it goes deeper than just colonization for black people. It's really a human trafficking issue where profits and a ransom, in a sense, is held and where resources are taken and stolen as a result. And so currently there's more black folks under the control of the prison system, much of which has to do with the drug war, than was in slavery in 1850. New Jersey has been on the forefront of, and because of advocacy, pushing the needle to bring that population down, but we still have a very far way to go. And New Jersey is a very strange place because to the rest of the nation, They look at New Jersey as a leader in these areas for a lot of this and see New Jersey as like a very liberal blue state, but it is extremely conservative. And the only things that have happened is because there's a very, very strong activist community that really pushes progressives, so-called progressives, to actually implement progressive policy. And so in the United States context and how we open this up and in regards to Nixon and the 50-year anniversary is very important in this entire context because it's the very way in which the connectivity and the continued oppression from the slave trade to Jim Crow to the current day continues. The drug war was the reaction to civil rights gains. The drug war was the way in which segregationists in the Democratic Party moved to the Republican Party. And so it's very important to understand why this critical anniversary, and in the context of the current insurrection that happened at the Capitol, it is all connected within all of this. And also to note that there's more and more evidence that a lot of law enforcement was present. And so if these are the law enforcement from New Jersey was present. And so it's very critical to understand that even in a so-called blue state like New Jersey, the folks who are enforcing oppressive drug policy and mostly Black neighborhoods are colonizing it from an explicitly racist, colonized human trafficking mindset. And that's where we find ourselves. So that's why New Jersey plays itself out to have the worst racial disparities in the prison system in the nation. And so it becomes critically important that abolishing the drug war and decriminalizing Black and brown bodies is so critical in order to disrupt the colonizing forces, and not just decolonize, but from the human trafficking standpoint, actually set people free, to finally be free. You know, from several different perspectives, I mean, there's first and foremost, whether legalization or decriminalization, I mean, justice starts with humanity and compassion, right? And eliminating cultural taboos. And so that is one. You know, how do we approach this? And even more so, how do we begin to put in policy and statute a way to deal with poor, marginalized Black and Latinx communities, the same things that have already been in place by default in rich white communities? That's first and foremost, because we saw right away with the opioid crisis, as opposed to the heroin crisis or the crack crisis in the United States, it right away, the posture and the compassion was totally different depending on who was the face of the crisis. And it's critical to understand that, because it isn't the particular crisis, because many Black communities are suffering from the opioid crisis as well. But even the face of it is treated differently, and even how the crisis is tended to. And so justice foremost kind of gives everyone a level field in humanity. So that's one. But then there's also the economic justice side. And so in New Jersey, right, the state was on record that legalization had to be done. They made all of the social justice arguments, and they admitted that the state had disproportionately enforced negative cannabis prohibition policies against Black and Latinx communities. And so as part of the major fight, we yelled and screamed and mobilized that then therefore, by your own admission, this is wrong, reparations must be had. If the state profits from taxes, from legalization, therefore those dollars should come back to the very communities that have been disproportionately affected, because there's an economic, major economic cost to all of this. And so justice looks like accountability, humanity, and repair. And then also underneath this economic lens, and this is a place we have yet to go in New Jersey, which we plan to work on next, is one of the major arguments in New Jersey that was used, and I think you find this all across the United States where legalization is either being discussed or happened already, is the need to thwart the Black market, or the underground market, as I would prefer to say, the non-traditional market, the unregulated market. And I think Ricky said it best, is that this is just a new form of colonization, right? Sisters and brothers in these communities are in the distribution business because there's no other, there's very little other pathways for survival. And so what we do is we not only all of a sudden try to move towards a legalization regulation standpoint without any repair, but we also now take away a means of survival, an economic engine within those very communities. And so the question must be that we must, and Isabel raised this earlier, there has to be, in order for it to be just, the mechanisms and the infrastructure and the dollars that circle back to lift the folks who were in those local markets, those underground markets, into the regulated market. Otherwise, it is not just. And that must be, I think, the major crux of where this entire movement goes in order to be just. Also, along with clearing the records and expungements and releasing anybody who is currently incarcerated, adjusting sentences where there's multiple sentences along with any given drug charge. All of that must be done in order for this to even begin to look like justice.
That was the Reverend Dr. Charles Boyer from New Jersey. He's the founding director of Salvation and Social Justice. He was speaking on a webinar held recently by the New School entitled Decolonizing Drug Policy, Perspectives from the Americas and Asia. And that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Thank you to everyone out there who's fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. Many thanks to our engineer. And of course, thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. Theme music for Free Culture Radio was composed and performed by Tom Nickel in Four Dimensional Nightmare. Find Free Culture Radio on the web at kboo.fm/freeculture. Free Culture Radio's on Facebook at facebook.com/kboofreecultureradio. Please give it a like. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!